Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Mario Ritter, and Dorothy Gundy. Ana Mateo will tell us what's trending today, and Marcia James will have this week's edition of People in America. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Israel is mourning the death of former President and Prime Minister Shimon Peres. Peres died on Wednesday at age 93. His death came 2 weeks after he suffered a severe stroke. Peres held nearly every major political position in Israel during his long career. He served as prime minister twice. He held the mostly ceremonial job of president from 2007 to 2014. He also served as foreign minister and defense minister. He was the longest-serving member of parliament in Israel's history, serving in the Knesset for 48 years. Peres was born in 1923 in what is now Belarus. He moved to Israel when he was 11 years old. By age 29, Peres became Israel's youngest defense minister in 1952. In that position, he was credited with developing the country's defense and aerospace industries. On Wednesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Peres had spent his life serving the Israeli people and trying to bring about peace.
He set his gaze on the future. He did so much to protect our people. He worked to his last days for peace and a better future for all.
Peres won the 1994 Nobel Peace Prize for his work in negotiating the historic Oslo Accords, which established limited self-rule for the Palestinians. He shared the award with then Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. The current Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, released a statement expressing sorrow and sadness over Peres's death. He called Peres a partner in making peace. He exerted persistent efforts to reach a just peace from the Oslo Agreement until the final moments of his life, Abbas said. In the United States, President Barack Obama praised his dear friend for representing Israel's courageous fight for independence. There are few people who we share this world with who change the course of human history, Obama said. Not just through their role in human events, but because they expand our moral imagination and force us to expect more of ourselves. Obama is on the list of world leaders expected to attend Peres's funeral in Jerusalem on Friday. Others expected to attend include former U.S. President Bill Clinton and his wife Hillary, Britain's Prince Charles, and French President François Hollande. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said Perez had been a good partner with the UN and was always hopeful about the chances for peace. May his spirit of determination guide us as we work to ensure peace, security, and dignity for Israelis, Palestinians, and all the peoples of the region, Bond said. Perez saw continuing violence between the Israelis and Palestinians and repeated breakdowns in negotiations. Yet he remained hopeful throughout his life. "I'm sure I shall see peace in my lifetime. Even if I should have to extend my life for a year or two, I won't hesitate," he said in 2013. 20 years ago, Shimon Peres launched the not-for-profit Peres Peace Center. It develops economic, educational, and cultural projects with the Palestinians, Egypt, and Jordan. He continued leading the center's peace efforts until suffering the stroke. I'm Brian Lynn.
Presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump set out sharply different ideas about America's allies in Asia during their debate Monday night. Clinton, a former United States Senator and Secretary of State, is the candidate of the Democratic Party. Trump, a businessman, is the Republican Party's choice for president. In the debate, Clinton noted existing U.S. agreements to defend the Asian allies with conventional or nuclear weapons if necessary. She sharply criticized Trump's earlier statements that suggested he might withdraw troops from Asia if elected.
"He has said repeatedly that he didn't care if other nations got nuclear weapons, Japan, South Korea, even Saudi Arabia."
Trump reacted to her comment by saying that Clinton was misrepresenting his position. He repeated his call for the allies to pay a greater share of security costs.
"All I said was they may have to defend themselves or they have to help us out."
Trump also said that he wanted to negotiate a better deal to get more support for defense efforts, aiding both sides. One reason is the U.S. government's budget deficit.
"We're a country that owes $20 trillion. They have to help us out."
The candidates did appear to agree on one thing. Both said that nuclear weapons were the biggest problem facing the world today. The Republican nominee said the possibility that terrorists might gain a nuclear device is the single greatest threat facing the United States. Clinton criticized the way Trump had spoken about nuclear weapons and the possibility that nations in Asia could acquire them.
"His cavalier attitude about nuclear weapons is so deeply troubling. That is the number one threat we face in the world, and it becomes particularly threatening if terrorists ever get their hands on any nuclear material."
U.S. nuclear policy has long been to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. Central to this effort is the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, which first became effective in 1970. In the past, Trump has called Japan and South Korea free riders. The United States has 50,000 troops in Japan and about 28,000 troops in South Korea. The U.S. forces are stationed there to help support peace and security in East Asia. However, Trump has said that these countries and others contribute too little to support the American troops. Trump has argued that, because the U.S. has large budget deficits, it no longer has enough money to keep large numbers of troops in bases overseas. It is estimated that Japan pays $1.6 billion toward the cost of U.S. troops there, and South Korea pays $866 million. On Tuesday, South Korean Foreign Ministry spokesman Cho Jun-hyuk said his country is closely watching the U.S. election. Officials there are considering how the vote might affect relations with the U.S. and the alliance with it.
I can tell you that our government has been contributing and playing a role to maintain and strengthen Korea-U.S. joint defense capability and provide stable conditions for the USFK to be stationed.
On Monday, the United States and South Korea carried out joint naval exercises, one of several major exercises this year. The commander of U.S. Naval Forces Korea, Brad Cooper, said the exercise was organized to show the unwavering strength and resolve of America and its military allies. Some U.S. lawmakers have moved to restate the country's long-standing guarantee of protection to its allies. In July, two members of the U.S. Senate wrote a commentary together. In it, Republican John McCain and Democrat Robert Menendez said the U.S. will meet its mutual defense treaty obligations no matter who is the next president. However, some lawmakers in South Korea's ruling Saenuri Party have expressed concern over the U.S. defense alliance. They are urging the South Korean government to develop its own nuclear weapons to defend against the growing North Korean threat. I'm Mario Ritter.
International investigators say a missile transported to Ukraine from Russia was responsible for shooting down Malaysia Airlines flight MH17. The Malaysian airplane crashed over eastern Ukraine in July 2014. The investigators released their findings Wednesday. They confirm an earlier investigation by the Dutch Safety Board. It found that the plane was brought down by a Russian-made surface-to-air missile. Russia has denied the Dutch finding. A year ago, the missile's manufacturer said it investigated the incident. It said the missile was an older model and no longer being used by the Russian military. The manufacturer also said the missile was launched from an area under Ukrainian government control. On Wednesday, investigators said there is strong evidence that the territory from which the missile was fired was controlled by pro-Russian fighters. The earlier investigation identified a 320 square kilometer area from which the rocket launch must have taken place. The investigators did not state clearly who fired the missile, but all of the land was under the control of separatist fighting Ukrainian forces. Wednesday, Russia said information from its radars proved that no rocket was fired from within territory held by pro-Russian separatists in Ukraine. Dmitry Peskov is a spokesman for the Russian government. In a telephone call with reporters, He said Russian radar had identified all flying objects over the rebel territory and did not show a rocket had been fired. The data are clear-cut. There is no rocket, he said. If there was a rocket, it could only have been fired from elsewhere. All 298 people on the aircraft died after it broke apart while on a flight from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. The majority of passengers were Dutch. Many were scientists planning to attend an international AIDS conference in Australia. The plane was also carrying citizens of Australia, Belgium, Malaysia, and Ukraine. Wednesday morning, before the announcement of the findings, officials met with family members of some of the people who died in the crash. One of the family members, Robbie Ohlers, told the Reuters news service the investigation had identified 100 people who could have launched the rocket. He said they found that it was launched from within rebel-held territory.
Russian Hill is one of the highest points in the city of San Francisco, and the neighborhood's name has a lot of history behind it. Historian Andrew Zibigalyan says a Russian cemetery was once nearby. People discovered it in the early days of San Francisco, over 150 years ago. That is when San Francisco was known for being the center of gold mining and trading in the United States. Earlier in Northern California, traders and sailors from the Alaskan Russian American Company called San Francisco home, and that is where they were buried. Some people call San Francisco the Paris of the West, but it has more Russian than French influences. For example, Holy Trinity Church was the first Russian church in the city. It opened in 1857 and was an important gathering place for Russian immigrants. At the Holy Trinity Church, St. Tikhon of Moscow once worked with worshipers. He became an American citizen in the early 1900s. Years later, he became Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church. He led the church from 1917 to 1925. San Francisco is also home to the Holy Virgin Cathedral. It is the largest Russian Orthodox church on the U.S. West Coast. A second group of Russian immigrants came to San Francisco after 1917, during Russia's Civil War. Their legacy is still felt at the Russian Center. At the center, you can visit the Museum of Russian Culture. Yves Frankian is the director of the museum. He said it is the largest Russian museum in the West. Many Russian immigrants from around the world donated their personal and family artifacts, Frankian said. This is a museum which reflects Russian life before and during the Bolshevik Revolution, and reflects the life of San Francisco's Russian colony since the 1920s. The Russian Center organizes events and classes for young people. They include kindergarten classes, dance classes, and gymnastics. The center is also open to people who do not speak Russian. Zoya Choglakova works at the center. She said the goal is not only to serve adults, but also help young people stay connected to their Russian roots. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
This is What's Trending Today. Elizabeth Murphy and Ryan Barclay were posing for wedding photos along a path in New York City's Central Park. It was already an exciting day in their lives. Murphy was wearing a beautiful white wedding dress. Barclay was wearing a formal black suit called a tuxedo. And then actor Tom Hanks showed up. He was exercising in the park. He was wearing shorts, a t-shirt, and a sweatshirt. The couple was surprised when he walked up and introduced himself. He said, "Hi, I'm Tom Hanks." Elizabeth asked, "Can we get a photo with you?" And he said, "By all means." Video and photos from the encounter are being shared on social media this week. Hanks is one of the most popular movie actors of all time. He is known for playing Forrest Gump, a stranded traveler on a small island in Castaway, and Woody the Cowboy in the Toy Story animated films. His current film, Sully, is the top new movie in the U.S. It tells the true story of a pilot who safely landed a commercial airplane on the Hudson River near New York City after both engines failed. Hanks posed with the couple, kissed the bride on the hand and cheek, and even took a selfie with his own phone. The meeting took just over a minute. One person in the group invited Hanks to the wedding, saying, "We have extra seats," but the actor declined, saying, "I think I have a dinner engagement." On Facebook, many people praised Hanks for being so friendly. One person wrote, "Such a gem of a human being." Others joked about his many movie roles. And that's What's Trending Today. I'm Ana Mateo.
That music is Symphony No. 2, known as the Resurrection Symphony. Austrian Gustav Mahler composed the piece in the late 1800s. Classical musician David Titcomb feels strongly about the composer and his work.
Mahler is just—it's so evocative, it's so emotional, and maybe those are cheap thrills, but to me, they're deep emotional works, especially the Resurrection Symphony.
Music has filled Titcomb's life from almost the start. An inspiring music teacher handed young David a trombone to play in elementary school. He could barely make a sound at that time, but he stuck with it. Titcomb studied music at the State University of New York Purchase. He went on to receive a Master of Fine Arts degree at Yale University School of Music. David Titcomb played the trombone professionally for more than 30 years. He says it was a difficult decision to stop playing and to do something else. Now, Titcomb is the managing director for the Philharmonia Orchestra of New York. The organization held its first performance last March. It hopes to bring new audiences to classical music. It aims to make performances higher tech and more affordable. Titcomb praises the more than 80 orchestra musicians, describing them as among New York's finest. Mahler Symphony No. 2 music is reflective of a project dear to David Titcomb's heart. David Titcomb has worked effortlessly along with Pony Principal conductor Maestro Atsushi Yamada on bringing the Philharmonia Orchestra of New York and more than 100 choral students from Japan together to perform. The program is called Project Hand in Hand. Project Hand in Hand aims to use performance to support disaster relief, cultural exchange, and education. David Titcomb says it is a collaboration.
With our good friend Atsushi Yamada, who's our conductor, who we worked with at New York City Opera back in the early 2000s, and we started as the Friends of Japan Orchestra, and we played a concert. Actually, it was the Resurrection Symphony, about a year after the disaster in northern Japan, and we brought over 100 kids just to kind of show them that we were still paying attention, and we wanted to give them some inspiration to continue to deal with their troubles and manage.
The joint performance with the Pony musicians and Japanese high school choir also includes students from American universities. Titcomb says the collaboration makes him happy. Hand in Hand was created in response to the earthquake and tsunami in Japan. Earlier this year, Japan marked the 5th anniversary of the earthquake and tsunami that devastated the country in 2011. More than 18,000 people died or disappeared. The 9.0 magnitude quake struck offshore, creating a huge, powerful surge of water that rushed inland. Whole towns were destroyed in moments. And the tsunami caused a major failure at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. The result was the worst nuclear disaster the world has ever seen. More than 150,000 people were forced to leave their homes. Many have not been able to return because of radiation danger. David says, just like the Resurrection Symphony No. 2 by Mahler, the music starts dark and has feelings of lost. And by the end of the symphony, it is a triumph resurrection and things are reborn. This is the hope David Titcomb and Pony have for the victims of the 2011 disaster in Japan. I'm Marcia James.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.